Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. I spend a fair amount of time during the year in Los Angeles, and one of my favorite rituals is after getting up and all of that, I head to a small shopping center just about two blocks away from where my wife and I stay. And one of the places that is an option for breakfast is a place called the Bagel Factory. And besides the fact that I really enjoy their bagels, I enjoy also going there because they always have free copies of a tabloid called Jewish Journal available. And I always pick one up because the articles are just great. Regardless of whatever religious or secular viewpoint you have, I suspect that if you are intellectually and spiritually curious, you would find something in there that would appeal to you. Well, earlier this month, I was in LA and I was at the Bagel Factory and I did pick up a copy of the Jewish Journal. And on the cover were a gaggle of smiley faces, emojis that obviously caught my eye. And the cover story is a Jewish take on happiness called Forging Happiness by Rabbi Mordecai Finley, who is in Los Angeles. And I read it, I loved it, and I thought it would be wonderful material for Common Threads. And so I contacted the rabbi, and he is here with us today. He was here last week as well. And we're talking about, again, forging happiness, happiness from a Jewish standpoint, although admittedly the message is really quite universal. Let me tell you a bit about our guest. Rabbi Mordecai Finley is one of the spiritual leaders of Or HaTorah Synagogue. He received his doctorate in religion, social ethics from the University of Southern California. In addition to his work at the synagogue, he serves as a professor of Jewish thought at the Academy for Jewish Religion in the California campus, where he has taught liturgy, Jewish mysticism and spirituality, and professional skills. Rabbi Finley also has a small counseling practice where he integrates insights from many schools and traditions beside Judaism, most notably several Greek philosophical schools, Jungian, existential, and humanist psychology. Through his doctorate in religion, as well as his own spiritual search, he has familiarity with other religious traditions, including Hinduism, Buddhism, and Sufi mysticism. He is a former U.S. Marine sergeant, so we welcome once again to Common Threads, Rabbi Mordecai Finley. Hello, Rabbi.
Hi there. Very happy to be back.
Yes, yes. Pleasure to have you. Now, last week when we introduced you, we started off by saying that in this article, you make the claim that Job was the happiest person in the Hebrew Bible. And we never really got to that because there's a lot to this article, so we were just working our way through, but I don't want to forget that because that's a very important point in the article. I don't want this half hour to slip away without digging into this. So I'm gonna start. Obviously, a lot of people are very surprised when they hear you say Job is the happiest person in the Hebrew Bible. So give us some insights there. Why this person who suffered so much, why is he happy?
I began when David Suisa, the editor-publisher of the Jewish Journal, called me and said, "Hey, Finley, can you do something on happiness?" I said, "Sure." I studied Martin Seligman's book, Authentic Happiness. I read others of his books. So I've read widely on this, and I teach what I call authentic happiness. So I thought, well, might as well start with the Bible. So I began thinking, if we assume authentic happiness is a person who can maintain a kind of stoic well-being in the face of adversity, I started thinking, well, not Adam and Eve. I mean, they were faced with temptation. They broke right away. So I'm thinking through Genesis, Abraham, no, Sarah, no, they're good people, but they all have, you know, profound failings. So I start thinking through the Bible, and I say, well, I'm not really finding anybody who held the line in the face of misfortune. So I said, I started asking people I know, who's the happiest person in the Bible? And people usually say, define happy, or somebody in the Bible was happy. So I said, okay, all right, let me now do what I normally do, which is do an etymological search. So I put in the Hebrew word for happy, which is ashrei, is the adjective. I loaded into my concordance, and I looked at all the moments, all the examples where the term ashrei occurs. So, for example, there are the metaphoric, ashrei yoshvei beitecha, happy are those, or those who dwell in your house have deep well-being. We'll translate it that way. And then I got to ashrei shomrei mishpat, oseh tzedakah b'chol et. Happy are those who keep the law and who do righteousness at all times. Now, mishpat has a sense of law, but it also has a sense of the fair laws that govern society. So happy are those who are always fair. They do the right thing. Oseh tzedakah b'chol et, and are righteous at all times. Now, I'm a rabbi. I know a lot of people who, at some point or another, couldn't be what you call shomer mishpat. And they didn't do tzedakah, righteousness, at all times. And then I looked at another verse that says, Ashrei ish yarei et Adonai. Ashrei is the person who reveres God and deeply desires God's commandments. Now, that might be ritual commandments, but from context, I don't think so. And then here's this one. I'll just give you one more. Ashrei temimei darech ha'olchim b'torat Adonai. Tamim in Hebrew means whole or wholeheartedly. So ashrei are those who wholeheartedly walk in the teaching of God. So I began to get an image of this, of an ashrei person, and I'm meditating. So who is described, you know, with some substance as having those virtues? What jumped into my head was the first verse from the book of Job. Ish haya be'eretz Utz Iyov shemo. There once was a man from the land of Utz. Job was his name. Now, by the way, Utz in Hebrew means advice. So you know we're talking about some kind of parable here. Once upon a time, there was a man from the land called Advice, and this man was tam, wholehearted, yashar, straight, yirei Elohim, revering God, sar mira, turning aside from evil. So I thought, ashrei, I mean, if we collected all the 40 verses in the Bible that talk about ashrei, add them all up, bottom line, this guy seems to be, you know, definitely, you know, if not the, a paradigm of ashrei. And then, you know, my head spun, to tell you the truth. I could not believe what I was thinking. And I said, okay, well, let me read the book of Job again and see what comes up. So I love the book of Job, especially the way Jack Miles has reinterpreted the end of the book of Job. And the deeper I got in, the more I understood what the book of Job is doing in the Bible. Remember, one of the meanings of a text is its mere canonicity, which means at some point in history, the early rabbis decided it is part of God's word and put in the Bible. And then we wonder, what holy teaching was it giving us? So here's a man who begins as ashrei, and then we look at the horrible things that have happened to him. And he ends up in this dramatic moment, which I think seals the idea of his being ashrei.
One thing I noticed in the article, you said that you see the Bibles as the Bible as literature, not a chronology. But wouldn't you agree that not all biblical books are created equal in that terms? I mean, do you see history in, say, Samuel, Judges, Kings, etc., as opposed to Job and the first part of Genesis?
Yeah, of course. So okay. Samuel is history.
Yes.
But remember, the author of Samuel is not just wants to tell you what happened between one year and another year. The author of Samuel has a story to tell. He has a story about the failures of ancient Israelite society. he has a story to tell about the people wanting a king when they have a king. They have a king in heaven. And God tries to talk them out of their king. And King Saul ends up bearing their king, and the failures of King Saul, and finding David, and David's successes and failures. So the book of Samuel, it is history, but the book itself is literature. So when you study the book of Samuel, the profundity of the literary dimensions just jump out. You need to look at, you know, one of the great scholars who discusses literature in the Bible, and they will really explain to you the literary dimensions of an historical book like Job. So even the books of history are literature.
Understood. You know, Job has always been one of my favorite books. To quote former presidential candidate John Dean, my favorite book in the New Testament. Do you remember that?
I don't remember, but thank you for telling me that.
Yeah, John Dean was asked about his favorite book in the Bible, and he said Job was his favorite book in the New Testament.
You mean Howard Dean?
I'm sorry, Howard Dean. Yeah, forgive me. Yeah, Howard Dean. Yes, not John Dean was Watergate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. That's pretty funny.
I know. Notice he did not become president.
Correct.
But one of the things that I've always appreciated about Job is the relationship between God and Satan. They're kind of like frenemies. Would you
exactly
say?
Right.
You know what it actually reminds me of? Do you remember the old Warner Brothers cartoons featuring Ralph the Wolf and Sam the Sheepdog?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, like they go to work together, they punch in together, and they're friends, and then all of a sudden, once they punch in, they have their work to do. Sam's job is to protect the sheep. Ralph's job is to steal the sheep. Do you see anything?
I love that. You know, and I remember when I was a kid watching it, I thought, that's brilliant. I mean, the brilliance of whoever wrote that, to have them checking in and out of work, it was, you know, as a child, I don't think I could comprehend it, but I knew it was really interesting. You know what's interesting for me, too? Huh. When they did the overture, you know, the Bugs Bunny overture?
Yes.
And all the characters would come out and stand on the stage and take a bow?
Yep.
So there they are, all of these enemies, and I realize they're just actors.
Exactly.
And so for the Warner Brothers to reveal to us, they're actors, folks, this stuff isn't really happening. little kid, I said, wow, what a trip.
Yes, we had a very similar experience. So tell us how this, I believe it is unique in the Bible, the relationship that we see between God and Satan in Job is different from other books in the Bible where God and Satan or Lucifer play parts. What did this do? What did Job do for Hebrew and possibly Christian theology?
The first two chapters there, number one, they are incredible literature, just on every literary level of building suspense, you know, of a resolution that one knows is not a resolution, and you start to have a sense of deep sense of dread to watch this thing played out. So just reading it literarily, in the Hebrew especially, but also in any other translated language, it is clearly not meant to be theology. So when people say to me, why does God in Job, I say, it's literature. It's not theology. It's not describing something that happened. So I say it's literature, not journalism. If this were a play, you know, if we were watching a play, Waiting for Godot, we wouldn't ask, well, I don't understand why Godot didn't show up since he's supposed to be there. And I say, well, it's a play. It's not journalism. So in this play, they need to set something up. And what they set up is God's, not only God's being arbitrary, which is a frightening prospect, but the fact that Satan can bamboozle God, that God has a weak point, and Satan knows what it is. So to see that exposed, I think I actually think this may have actually been performed. The speeches are such great oratory, I can't imagine them being limited to the written word. So I think those who saw this play would see God's, God's kind of fecklessness in the face of Satan needling him and God failing. So in a way, who is God not? God is not Ashrei. God's the guy who folds in the beginning of the book of Job. So God is, if you read the first two chapters, God is diminished. And Satan comes out as very clever, having gotten into the weakness of God. And then who bears the consequences of God's weakness is Job. So in a very strange way, something divine passes from God to Job.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Rabbi Mordecai Finley. And we're talking about his article that appears in the Jewish journal, Forging Happiness. Now, you mentioned in your article that this book by Miles that you referenced just a couple of minutes ago, it like changed your entire perspective of Job. Is what you're talking about right now, is that from the book? And you also mentioned a particular verse that...
No, the first two chapters are what I would say any thoughtful person's reading of the first two chapters, if you take it as literature, not journalism, well, what happens? And what you have is the failure of God, the cleverness of Satan, and you realize that God's failure is now, the consequence of God's failure is placed on Job. That's the dreadful consequence of those first two chapters. So I think any reader can see that.
Okay. So where does this epiphany that you received from reading
Miles? Okay. So we, the reader, know that when Job's friends come and say, you must have done something wrong, and Job says, look, A, God is just, and B, I did nothing wrong. And his friends say, come off it, Job. Everybody knows. And they have this great oratory about what everybody knows. And Job says, look, I'm not bending. Job's wife says, curse God and die. Obviously, all of these calamities and catastrophes would not happen had you not had some flaw that you can't see. You know, it's the great flawed character in Greek tragedy, the fatal flaw that the person carried that they can't see but the audience can. So we might assume he's the flawed hero, except that we know he's not because we read the first two chapters. The flawed hero is God. Job's the guy who is exactly as he's described as. He's the guy who's straight. He's Tam v'yashar. He's a wholehearted straight guy, and he stays wholehearted and straight. So the book is his friends trying to dissuade him from his position, and Job responding. And again, the literature is exquisite. Now, Miles' insight comes from when, for example, when God finally speaks in chapter 38, God responds to Job. And by the way, Job keeps saying to God, you must speak, you must speak, you have to answer me. So 38, God responds to Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this who gives murky counsel, words without knowledge? And God goes on and on and on, recounting God's magnificent deeds, God's great power. And Job is listening quietly as God said, were you there when I created the earth? Were you there when I did this, when I did that? And that's not the point. So Job is, listening to all this and thinking to himself, really impressive, but you're not answering my question, which is, why is this happening to me? So again, the reader there feels God is obfuscating. Now, as we move over to chapter 40, God says, can one who contends with God be arrogant? One who argues with God must answer. Job says, I'm deficient. What can I say? I'm going to put my hands over my mouth. I spoke once, earlier. I'm not going to speak again. He doesn't want to antagonize God, but everything Job had to say, he said. So God says again, gird your loins like a lawyer, and more of this trying to overwhelm Job with God's power. And chapter 41 ends, and chapter 42, verse 1, Job responded to God. Now, there's what's called a Korean kativ. There's the way that the Hebrew word was written, but then the tradition suggests that we read it differently. So Job responds and says, and in the original Hebrew, it says, Vayomer, hold on a second, Vaya'an Iyov et Adonai, Yadati, I knew. So the corrective says, you know, but let's go with the original. You know that you can do anything, and nothing is withheld from you. And then Job quotes God and says, Mize ma'alim etzar bli dat? Who is this giving murky counsel without knowledge? Now Job is now saying, speaking for himself, Lachen higadati. Yeah, I said stuff. Velo avin, and I didn't understand. Nifla'ot mimeni, wonder, things too wondrous for me. Velo eda, things I could not know. And then he quotes again, Shema na v'anochi adaber, you listen and I will speak. Esh alcha v'hodieni, I will ask and you answer me. And now Job, speaking for himself, says, Leshema ozen shmaticha, I heard about you with my ear. Ve'ata eini ra'atcha, and now my eye sees you. Al ken emas, therefore I'm disgusted. V'nichamti al afar ve'efer, and I pity humanity. Now, most Bibles will not translate that way, but Jack Miles shows you by mere emendations of one point of punctuation, it changes the whole thing. So Job is not repenting. Job is not admitting. Job is saying, now I see you, and I pity humanity.
That's pretty powerful. That can change a lot.
Think what's happened here is now you might say, you know, those movies when the actor finally learns the truth, the horrible hidden truth, and the look on their face, they suddenly realize what's been going on the whole time, and they finally get it.
Yes, yes.
I think when God never answers his question, Job is suddenly realizing something too horrible to imagine. God let this happen, and Job didn't deserve it. Now Job got his answer, because Job kept maintaining, God is just, I didn't sin, there's something I don't know. And now he realizes, God is not just. God cannot explain this. And he's saying, oh no, this is what it is. And I'm disgusted by what I've just learned. And I pity humanity. Something like, if you're the God of this humanity, I pity humanity. Now, what is the book of Job attacking? In my mind, the book of Job is attacking what we call, you know, the theology of the book of Proverbs. Now, I love Proverbs, but I find it highly annoying. Why? Because Proverbs, like the Deuteronomic theology, seems to say, I mean, it says very clearly, if you do good, I will bless you, or if you do good, blessings will follow. And if you don't do good, afflictions will follow. So people think, well, if I do good, God is rewarding me, and if I suffer, God is punishing me. Many people instinctively think this, even though there's no evidence for that anywhere. You know, when my Hebrew school kids say it, I said, is there any evidence that God rewards the good or punishes the wicked? None whatsoever. I said, so I don't believe it. And I don't, you know, the Bible may say it here and there, but that's not really borne out. So I think the Bible, in a way, has snuck in a book of the Bible that says, yeah, there are those who believe in the book of Proverbs, and they have a right to be in the Bible. But there's others who say that book of Proverbs stuff, that God rewards the good and punishes the wicked, it's not true, never was true, and get over it. So I say that, you know, Proverbs is a holy book, but Job is a holy book. Now, to today's people, many people who have abandoned religion because they just don't believe, you know, that God rewards the good and punishes the wicked. I say the Bible doesn't believe it either. There's at least one book in the Bible that casts doubt on that idea of God's providence. I say if you believe in God's providence, read Mishle, read Proverbs. But if you don't believe in God's providence, read the book of Job. There's room for both of us in the Bible.
But the book of Proverbs, that fairly clearly indicates that this reward for goodness is not otherworldly. It's
correct.
This world.
Absolutely right.
All right. And a lot of people would interpret that, though, just interpret not necessarily the book of Proverbs, but the understanding of God punishing the wicked and rewarding the just as otherworldly. Like, okay, you're not in great shape right now, but just wait until you die. That's when you get your reward.
Okay. And I say to people, therefore what? Therefore what? You're going to get rewarded in the next life.
Right. I mean, that's
are you telling me that you're good for that reward? Is that why you're being good? Because that's not called good. That's called being prudential.
Very good point, too. Absolutely.
I said, like, why make that up? You see, if a person says, oh, no, but I'll be rewarded in the next life, I said, who's talking about getting rewards here? We're talking about being good. So when people talk about reward in the next life, I say, why are you even interested in it? Because if doing good is doing it for its own sake, being wholehearted and straight like Job, don't say I'm doing it for the reward. Leave that to God. People say, well, what do you think happens? I say, you know, it's above my pay grade. I know what I'm supposed to do here. Whatever happens in the next life, that's up for God to decide. I'm not interested in it. Because I never want to see myself as doing something stoically moral. Because there's a reward waiting for me, because then, in a way, that robs the moment of its moral value and makes it merely prudential. I'm taking this straight from Immanuel Kant, that you have to do the good for the sake of the good.
I understand that. Rabbi, we are down to the wire again, and it's been a fascinating conversation. I so appreciate your time this week and last week.
It's been a real pleasure, Fred. Thank you very much.
Certainly. And people who are interested in reading this really wonderful article that you wrote, Forging Happiness, it is now online at jewishjournal.com. And Rabbi, you have your own website with blogs and events going on at your synagogue. What is that?
Yes, I do. Mine is called rabbifinley.com, and then we have the synagogue website. Both are a little bit deficient in getting everything up, but we're working on it. But there's stuff up there on rabbifinley.com and my synagogue, orhatorah.org.
Wonderful. Well, once again, thank you so much. You're listening to
Common... It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, Rabbi Mordecai Finley, our guest today. Please join us again next week for another edition of Common Threads.